Chapter 1. Shifting Paradigms. In my sophomore year of high school, I played Golda from the musical Fiddler on the Roof, a play set in an early 1900s Russian village. I was playing the part of a Jewish mother who, along with her husband, was highly determined to marry off her daughters to the right match. One of the songs I sang in the show was Sunrise, Sunset, where my character reflects on the passing seasons, how quickly her children have grown, and whether she's been able to pass on enough of her support and wisdom. You may recall the chorus part, which goes, "Sunrise, sunset, swiftly fly the years, one season following another, laden with happiness and tears." As you can probably already surmise, there are plenty of patriarchal assumptions and mononormative expectations in this play that I could easily critique, but that's actually not the main point of this specific anecdote. Now, decades later, past my musical theater days, during the grind of a typical work week, I sometimes hear myself singing the lyrics, "Sunrise, sunset, swiftly fly the years." When I'm in the crunch hour, especially, of trying to get my son fed, ready and packed for school, while also making myself look presentable for work and making sure the cat litter is clean. It's precisely in these moments where I feel the tension of being in the automated wash, rinse, repeat cycle of modern life that my mind can spin off with perplexity about how I live in a society where we have bound ourselves to the social constructs of consumerist capitalism, constant productivity, and our purely fictitious yet ever-quickening relationship to time. While there is nothing inherently inevitable or objectively true about these fundamental tenets of contemporary North American civilization, the fact that I am so thoroughly subject to their influence makes it seem as if they reflect the very fabric of the universe itself. Recently, however, while hearing myself chant the chorus, "Sunrise, sunset," I had a completely different reflection about how strange and yet completely commonplace it is that we still use the words sunrise and sunset to explain the daily activity of the sun. While modern astronomy has convincingly demonstrated that the sun neither rises nor sets, curiously, we still use these outdated terms to describe the Earth's rotation on its axis. On the surface, this is a simple song, a beautiful lament about the passing of time and the parental concern about whether or not we've done enough for our children. However, on a deeper level, the lyrics point to the tremendous difficulty implicit in changing the way we think about the world. Written in the early 1960s, this song came out over 400 years after Nicholas Copernicus presented his revolutionary hypothesis dethroning the Earth as the previous center of our universe. This Earth-centric paradigm, which posited the sun as simply one of the many celestial spheres revolving around our planet, completely dominated and shaped our perceptions and myths, even our language. Despite the fact that the empirical evidence via telescope, satellite, and human space travel undeniably confirms the sun's centrality in our solar system, we still unthinkingly ask our smart devices questions like, "What time is sunrise tomorrow?" instead of, "When is daybreak?" or "When is dawn?" In a similar way, I find it interesting how many people, myself included, still reflexively say, "Bless you," when someone sneezes. The origins of this custom date back to a time when Christians actually believed a sneeze represented a moment of metaphysical vulnerability where evil spirits could enter your body and take control of your soul. Saying, "God bless you," was like a protective talisman offered more out of fear than societal social courtesy, which was meant to literally prevent potential demonic possession. And yet, while today you would probably find it hard to find someone who truly believes they're actually saving your soul by saying, "Bless you," the expectation to say it is so ingrained that our very moral integrity could fall into question if we don't. In fact, as a therapist, I have been advised by other professionals that if I happen to sneeze during a session and my client doesn't say bless you to me in response, I could then reasonably suspect that they have narcissistic or sociopathic tendencies or simply lack sufficient emotional rapport to care about my well-being. I don't believe this, for the record, but it's fascinating how such a simple phrase carries so much weight. Both of the previous examples about sunrises and sneezes are mundane, everyday occurrences that illustrate how deeply ingrained our ways of thinking and acting can become over time. Even though these particular examples carry relatively little impact on our lived experience, it's still curious to note how persistent they are, even in the face of ample evidence to refute their accuracy or truthfulness. I sometimes ask myself what it would actually take to get people to no longer use the word sunrise or forsake saying bless you. Even more intriguing, perhaps, is the question, if it's this difficult to change fairly inconsequential customs and behaviors such as these, how much more challenging is it to change the way we fundamentally understand and experience love, romance, sex, and partnership? Whether you are brand new to non-monogamy or have already been practicing it in some form for many years, this is precisely the question you face when relating outside of the dominant couple-centric paradigms of monogamy. You must figure out how to live out your non-monogamous ideals despite the persistent influence of this monogamous paradigm. Whether that influence shows up as deeply ingrained ideas within yourself or in someone with whom you are in partnership. Quite often, this is no small task. What is a paradigm? The term paradigm was popularized by Thomas Kuhn in his 1962 book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, wherein he discusses how the various branches of disciplines of Western science, such as physics, biology, chemistry, and geology, each have their own overarching theories, functioning to connect various ideas, pieces of information, and experiences into a coherent whole. A paradigm is a particular view of the world that emerges to provide an overall framework for understanding different aspects of our reality. Interestingly, a geologist, biologist, or chemist could each be examining the very same event or piece of data and yet have a completely different hypothesis, interpretation, or conclusion about what they are observing. Even within the same field of study, such as psychology, there can be differing paradigms such as behaviorism, cognitive psychology, evolutionary psychology, and social constructivism, all with vastly different answers to questions such as what makes us tick as humans, or what mental health is, and what the best means for achieving it are. Since Kuhn's foundational work, the notion of paradigms has expanded beyond the sciences to everyday life, becoming a more general term that is now synonymous with our different worldviews or lenses through which we can see and experience life. When trying to make sense of the world around us, we use paradigms to organize and consolidate the interpretations we make of things. They are the constructs and belief systems we use to make sense of the world and give our lives meaning. Something as commonplace as the birth of a human being or the growth of a tree can be interpreted as evidence for the existence of God or the proof of evolution, depending on whether you're anchored in a religious or a scientific paradigm. The different religious, economic, political, and cultural paradigms that construct our society also frame our realities, guide our expectations, shape our wants and preferences, and even help us sort, organize, and classify the information we receive through our physical senses. One of my favorite examples of how our paradigms shape our actual perception and physiology comes from the sexualization of female breasts. In many cultures around the world, women's breasts are sexualized as erotic objects. Even though this phenomenon is purely a social construct, because of the physiological arousal that many experience in response to seeing, touching, or thinking about breasts, the desire is believed to be innate and hardwired into us as humans, especially if you are a heterosexual male. This is absolutely the experience of many, regardless of their chromosomes, genitals, or gender. In the presence of breasts, real, virtual, or imagined, they experience physical pleasure, involuntary pupil dilation, and increased blood flow to the genitals. To them, the appeal of breasts is experienced as their objective reality and truth, not some belief system they could just change at will. For such individuals, the physiological response typically associated with pleasure that results from seeing or touching breasts confirms the impression that breasts in and of themselves are inherently arousing. This is the true power of our paradigms to shape our lived reality. However, the sex appeal of women's breasts is not universal across all cultures or throughout history. In previous times, the buttocks and the ankles were considered erotically irresistible, with breasts getting much less attention. Also, certain indigenous cultures, such as the Piraha people of Brazil, do not sexualize women's breasts at all, and even find humor in the colonizers' obsession with them. The reason that one culture or society can put breasts on a sexual pedestal and worship them as if they were inherently erotic, while another can be utterly indifferent towards them, is because of the differences between each culture's paradigm of physical attractiveness and sexuality. The culture's paradigm dictates what is arousing and what isn't worth paying attention to sexually. Whatever the paradigm says is sexy becomes culturally acceptable and is more likely to trigger the physiological responses that then reinforce the quote-unquote natural desirability of the thing itself. So much so that any departure from the norm can earn you the label of being kinky, having a fetish, or being sexually deviant. However, once you step outside of the dominant paradigm, this quote-unquote naturalness of our preferences can start to come into question. As we see from this example, our paradigms have the power to create not only our cognitive and emotional experiences, but our physical sensations and behavioral habits as well. They influence how we think, feel, and act, often without us even realizing it. In the same way that a fish doesn't know it's swimming in water, our paradigms are often invisible to us, taken for granted, and passed down from one generation to the next. Statements such as, "That's just how things are supposed to be," or "That's what's normal around here," or "Everybody knows," are all signposts of the cultural belief systems that dictate what ways of being are considered acceptable and unacceptable. Sometimes our inherited traditions and taken-for-granted ways can be benign, such as holding the door for a stranger at the grocery store or shaking hands with someone you're meeting for the first time. However, many of our everyday assumptions and beliefs about how people are supposed to be, how they are supposed to look, and behave can be problematic or harmful. Many of the beliefs that masquerade as quote-unquote right, natural, or common sense are actually paradigmatic beliefs rooted in racism, sexism, homophobia, and polyphobia. Reaching the limits of our paradigms. Let's return to Thomas Kuhn for a moment. He believed that our paradigms, while helpful and necessary, could also become a trap, limiting our perspectives and eclipsing other viewpoints, evidence, or experiences that fall outside of our paradigm's purview. This is similar to the well-known phenomenon in psychology called confirmation bias, where our brains tend to only seek out, believe, and remember information that confirms our current beliefs, and then systematically ignore, disregard, or write off any information that challenges or contradicts our fundamental worldview. Once a paradigm theory is established, those working within it can start doing what Kuhn calls the normal science, which begins to account for most of what is considered acceptable and appropriate for any given scientist within their respective field of study. In the same way, because we live in a society where we are conditioned to internalize the monogamous paradigm as a default standard for relationships, it's incredibly difficult for us to think about things like dating, sex, marriage, or having a family outside of the quote-unquote normal parameters of relationship set forth by monogamy. But what happens when our paradigms are no longer sufficient to describe the fullness of our experience? What happens when we encounter repeated anomalies that cannot be easily explained by the dominant paradigm? What happens when the norms into which we've been acculturated are unable to explain what we personally feel, think, or desire? When we are exposed to world events, scientific data, different identities, personal experiences, or have our own wants that fall outside of our current paradigm, it can be extremely unsettling. Paradigms are like the tectonic plates of meaning upon which our very identities are constructed. And when they are called into question, we can feel as though we are on the verge of an existential crisis. The framework we relied on in the past to make sense of ourselves or the world is no longer adequate. This leads to a turning point where we have to abandon the old paradigm and discover a new way of looking at the world. According to Kuhn, quote, when paradigms change, the world itself changes with them. It is rather as if the scientific community itself has been suddenly transported to another planet where familiar objects are seen in a different light and are joined by unfamiliar ones as well. Kuhn called this change from one way of thinking to another a scientific revolution. And his description is particularly relevant when we think about the stark differences between monogamous and non-monogamous paradigms. As the old view is replaced by the new, the individual is irrevocably changed by their relationship to the new way of seeing the world. As U.S. physician Oliver Wendell Holmes once said, quote, the human mind, once stretched to a new idea, never returns to its original dimensions. The reason for this is that the new model offers an expanded vision of the world. It seems better suited to reflect our own lived experiences and usually gives us a better or fuller description of the world based on the available evidence. For example, before the arrival of Einstein's theory of relativity and the subsequent quantum revolution of the 20th century, Newtonian theory dominated the world of Western physics, describing the universe in very mechanistic terms. However, when modern scientists discovered the subatomic world, the need for a new model to describe our increasingly complex universe became unavoidable. We simply could not rely on the old paradigm to understand our world anymore. Similarly, as more and more people recognize that their personal experiences of gender or sexuality do not neatly fit within the paradigm of a binary construction, the need has arisen for us to develop a new paradigm that conceives of these elements of human experiences as existing on a spectrum. Paradigm shifts are different for everyone. People come to non-monogamy from many different starting points. For some, no matter how hard they tried, the monogamous paradigm never felt quite right, and their relational world only made sense when they discovered CNM. Others may have initially experienced monogamy like a comfortable pair of shoes that eventually wore thin and needed to be changed out for something that fit better. Some are drawn to CNM because they have struggled with the exclusivity of being with only one person. and they have felt philosophically misaligned with the tenets of monogamy and find more resonance with the principles and practices of CNM. Some find their way into CNM through kink or queer avenues via their experiences with a different paradigm altogether. Others, despite their faithfulness to their partner, have inwardly longed for more relational and sexual diversity and desire the opportunity to have new experiences. For some, leaving behind monogamy was a very conscious and deliberate decision, which clearly necessitated the search for a new paradigm to guide their journey. For still others, the idea of CNM would never have even crossed their minds unless it was for someone else, such as a close friend, a curious partner, introducing it to them. Just as the paths that lead people to non-monogamy can be very different, so too are the processes of integrating a non-monogamous paradigm. For example, some people experience non-monogamy as if it were the lost blueprint of their romantic essence. Something in their soul just seems to recognize its wisdom, and they embody it with relatively little resistance or struggle. For others, however, the integration process can be much less elegant or easy. Some are drawn to the philosophy and principles of non-monogamy, but struggle with managing the challenges that arise in their relationships. Even though they resonate intellectually and emotionally with the tenets of non-monogamy, their nervous system, conditioned by years of monogamous expectations, can struggle to accept the changes that come along with practicing it. In such cases, people can experience a kind of CNM paradigm jet lag, where their nervous system needs time to rewire itself and catch up to the new reality. It's simply not enough to be on board with the ideas of non-monogamy. We must also integrate the new worldview into our very ways of relating. This, for many, is easier said than done. When looking back at some of the major paradigm shifts that I, myself, have made over the years, I am reminded that each big life change was either helped or hindered by a series of different factors and circumstances. When comparing some of those previous experiences, I am able to better understand the unique constellation of conditions that ultimately paved the way for my transition into new paradigms. For instance, when I first read about Buddhism when I was around 18 years old, it was very easy for me to cast aside the Catholic and Jewish beliefs that I grew up immersed in. I had an immediate resonance with the philosophical underpinnings of Buddhism that just felt intuitively in alignment with how I perceived the world to be. I was already aware of the fact that the Judeo-Christian worldview of my larger social environment was incongruent with many of my core political, moral, and spiritual values, and thus there simply wasn't much psychic residue from the dominant religious narrative for me to excavate or rid myself of. To make matters easier, I experienced zero resistance from anyone important in my life about changing my spiritual and philosophical beliefs at that time. Numerous resources were also readily available on bookstore shelves on Eastern philosophy, meditation, and mindfulness, which greatly facilitated my spiritual paradigm shift. I had the advantage of having plenty of retreats, spiritual teachers, and local meditation groups to choose from, and my family and friends were more curious, even eager, to hear about the changes I was making. So even though I was technically entering into a minority paradigm in terms of the socio-spiritual context in which I lived, I experienced myself absolutely no marginalization. Changing my diet in my mid-20s after developing serious autoimmune issues of the gut was another story. I was diagnosed with a significant allergy to not only gluten, but all grains as well. Even though I was raised eating gluten-dense foods for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and was a vegetarian for years, I was forced to make a complete 180 with my eating habits from vegetarian to paleo practically overnight. To this day, eating out in restaurants remains extremely challenging, if not impossible, because I am constantly faced with the possibility I will be served food that can cause serious immune reactions. This has also meant that seemingly normal activities such as buying food at a regular grocery store, eating out with colleagues at conferences, or attending social events are complicated for me, or simply not an option anymore. This has led me to seek a radically different paradigm of food, nutrition, and health from the one I was raised in, and which is still prevalent in the world at large. My whole relationship to food has drastically changed. Where previously I could take advantage of the conveniences of dining out or grabbing something on the go, I now have to cook almost all of my own meals every single day, consuming a significant amount of time that, quite frankly, I would prefer to spend doing other things. Even the typical dating options to meet over drinks or dinner are usually off the table for me due to my food restrictions. But as much as it's a pain in the ass to function within the parameters of this laborious alternative food paradigm that I'm in, which has led to an extremely isolating impact on my social life, I'm actually fully on board with it. Despite the challenges implicit in this new lifestyle, I'm healthier because of the changes I've made. And I have actually healed my gut as well as the associated mental health issues I had experienced as a result of my autoimmune condition. When comparing my experiences of changing my spiritual and culinary paradigms, despite the fact that only one of these paradigm shifts meant facing significant and difficult consequences externally, internally, my experience of making both of these changes felt relatively similar. The things they both shared is alignment, a deep clarity that these paradigm shifts were necessary and undeniable, regardless of the possible external implications that accompanied their implementation. Inwardly, I felt no vacillation, very little resistance. Thus, it didn't matter to me if the world agreed with my decision or not. It was precisely this intrinsic congruence that made the changes feel doable, even in moments of difficulty or inconvenience. For some people, the transition to CNM is like mine with Buddhism. It resonates with who they feel themselves to be. Their hearts and minds experience little to no resistance to the shift, and they may even experience little social impact from technically being in a minority. People who experience their shift from monogamy to non-monogamy in this way may then also find it difficult to understand why the transition can be so challenging for their partners. On the flip side, people who don't experience their shift to CNM with this level of ease and grace may judge themselves for the difficulties they face, taking on the story that they should be able to make a change without difficulty, struggle, or resistance. For other people, their paradigm shift to non-monogamy looks more like my experience with my diet, where the choice to make the shift wasn't something they would have necessarily chosen on their own, but because of life circumstances, was necessary to take on. And they remained committed to seeing it through. Over time, they recognized how non-monogamy was actually more in alignment with their personal values. And they realized they wouldn't go back to monogamy even if they could, despite the ostensible convenience and comfort it seems to offer. But what about paradigms that feel harder to get on board with internally? For example, practically every time I start shaving my legs in the shower, I am painfully reminded of how patriarchy has influenced my perception of my own body, making me judge my own legs as prettier when shaved than in their natural hairful state. Why, after so much conscious effort to deconstruct the expectations of capitalist beauty culture, and after so many books and courses on how to love my body no matter what it looks like, do I still struggle with my body image? From over-exercising to under-eating, I have at times literally done myself harm in the name of trying to be thin. Even though I conceptually know that beauty is subjective, socially constructed, and ever-changing throughout history, I have nevertheless internalized the false belief that, as a white, cisgender woman, I am supposed to look a certain way. And if I don't, my attractiveness, value, lovability, worthiness, and womanliness are all called into question. When the inner voice of the body critic kicks up, it's like a virus taking over my mind, getting me to think and behave in ways that are actually harmful to myself. Over the past 2 decades, I have come a long way, but the shift into full body positivity is still very much a work in progress. Compared with the other paradigmatic shifts I've made, this one feels glacial and beyond my capacity to just hurry it along. Thankfully, I am no longer imprisoned the same ways I used to be, and I can see the old paradigm for what it is and relate to it differently. However, it would be a lie to say that I no longer feel or experience the very real and concrete impacts of those narratives on my sense of self. Despite my lucid recognition of its fallacy and all of my best efforts to undo my attachment to the story that I need to look a certain way in order to be worthy, at times I still fall under its spell. The spell of a paradigm that I am actively resisting. Similarly, for many of us, the integration of consensual non-monogamy into our relational lives is not a quick, easy, or pain-free process. Whether pursuing CNM as an orientation, as an experiment, or for philosophical reasons, we can still experience significant resistance and difficulty as we detox from the deeply ingrained ideas of monogamy that continue to linger in our consciousness. Regardless of whether you are new to open relating or have been polyamorous for years, sometimes it can feel as though you're trying to let go of a paradigm that doesn't want to let go of you. When you add the moral judgment of the puritanical monogamous culture and the negative opinions and potential rejection of friends and loved ones, it can become extremely challenging to fully embrace and embody consensual non-monogamy in the ways you really want to. New paradigms as a catalyst. New paradigms not only serve as the conceptual frameworks for new experiences, they also give us an important contrast against which we can better understand our own journey as individuals. When functioning within a certain paradigm, we are simply oblivious to many aspects of it. Often we can recognize its shortcomings only by stepping outside of it. New paradigms act like gateways to things that were previously unavailable. And by experiencing the novel opportunities afforded by them, we can more clearly see the ways old paradigms limited our sense of what was possible. By recognizing what didn't work for us in a previous paradigm, we can get much more clarity about what we want for ourselves now and for the future. Therefore, as you deepen your relationship to CNM, you are simultaneously given the opportunity to see the potential for new, more fulfilling ways of relating, while also being forced to confront what hasn't worked up until this point. In this sense, embracing a non-monogamous paradigm can be a powerful catalyst for change that requires partners to both learn new things and address old dysfunctional patterns of behavior. The stark contrast between a monogamous paradigm and a non-monogamous one can expose a variety of issues that were either not a problem in the monogamous context or were there but simply masked by the structure of monogamy. What worked to keep a relationship functional in monogamy is often insufficient to keep relationships healthy and functional in non-monogamy. The greater degree of relational complexity means you have to increase your communication skills, emotional intelligence, STI awareness, relationship to time management, and ability to handle conflict, among other things. It is precisely this difference in complexity, along with the subsequent need to develop new skills to handle it, that represents both one of the most compelling gifts and challenges of CNM. As we experience the increased complexity of managing multiple intimate relationships at the same time, we are simultaneously brought face to face with new and exciting aspects of our relational selves, as well as painful and uncomfortable realizations about the places where we still have a lot to learn. In my work with clients, these difficult places most often have their roots in the lingering tenets of a monogamous paradigm, which typically only come to light in the context of non-monogamous relationships. Many individuals are already well aware of the dominant influence of monogamy and have been actively working to deconstruct it and disentangle themselves from it for quite some time. Those who practice non-hierarchical styles of CNM, including solo polyamory or relationship anarchy, are most likely very aware of the ways a couple-centric perspective can infiltrate the dynamics of their relationships. For them, the challenges that arise are often not a result of making a new paradigm shift per se, but rather are the secondary effects of dating someone who is still in a process of monogamous detox or whose partners are. In situations such as these, the direct impact on you may be more related to the need for holding space for one of your partners or metamors as they grapple with the withdrawal symptoms of a lifetime of monogamous social conditioning. Support for making the non-monogamous paradigm shift. The rest of this chapter focuses on some concepts, contemplations, and exercises to support you in making the non-monogamous paradigm shift. Some experiences will speak more to people who are newer to CNM, but what I have found is that these exercises can be relevant to people who have been practicing CNM for years, but now find themselves in new CNM transitions. These can include changing the style of CNM that you or your partners are practicing, changing your configuration from a couple to a triad or a quad, or the reverse, introducing more commitment, prioritization, roles, decision-making power, or nesting into a relationship, de-escalating a relationship, or even dating people who are relatively new to CNM. Chapter 2 offers even more ideas and practices to support you when troubleshooting larger resistance to the transition from monogamy to CNM. Based on what has been discussed in this chapter, here are some questions to consider. Paradigms. What paradigms were you born into? What different paradigms are you situated in today? How have these different paradigms shaped your understanding of yourself? How have these different paradigms shaped your understanding of love, romance, and sex? Paradigm shifts. What paradigm shifts have you made in your life? What factors or conditions made these paradigm shifts easier or more difficult for you? Did you gain certain skills, capacities, or perspectives in those paradigm shifts that you can apply to your CNM paradigm shift? What brought you to the paradigm of non-monogamy? In your opinion, what are the benefits of the monogamous paradigm? What are the limits or costs of the monogamous paradigm? What do you see as the benefit of a non-monogamous paradigm? What are the limits or costs of a non-monogamous paradigm? Paradigms as a catalyst. In either learning about or practicing a non-monogamous paradigm, what has it catalyzed for you and your relationships? What things have become better for you and what has become harder? If you opened up from a monogamous relationship, how has your partner's relative ease or difficulty with the shift impacted you and your relationship? Consenting to consensual non-monogamy. As many people already know, non-consensual non-monogamy has the power to break up families, destroy relationships, and even ruin lives. Even though some relationships are absolutely able to recover from affairs, it is also completely understandable when this type of betrayal and broken trust are beyond repair. While it may seem obvious to say that if you or your partner are pursuing non-monogamy, everyone needs to consent to it, I actually come across a surprising number of situations where full and explicit consent is missing among partners. In cases like these, what I typically see is that one partner is excitedly nudging a relationship into non-monogamy or a new style of non-monogamy, while another individual is resistant or still on the fence about making the change. In this sense, the reluctant partner has actually not given their full consent and is potentially being pressured or coerced into jumping from one paradigm or style to another. Because of the enormity of the shift from a monogamous paradigm to a non-monogamous one, I find it essential that people first connect to their own quote-unquote yes on their own terms before committing to this process. Far too often, unilateral decisions are made from the relationship by an overeager partner who has taken a maybe or a hesitant yes or tentative acquiescence as permission to start their exploration with other people. This kind of quote-unquote consent ends up creating a tremendous amount of emotional damage that must later get cleaned up. I learned from Zach Budd, clinical social worker, sexual educator, and consent advocate, about the idea of having a hell yes as a primary prerequisite to true consent. As a response to the prevalence of rape culture, consent culture has arisen to assert and normalize the act of asking for consent. It is a deliberate attempt to recognize and empower the individual's unconditional right to say no to anything that feels out of alignment with what they want for themselves. With consent, the autonomous and sovereign ownership of our body is respected, which applies not only to sexual activity, but to any kind of relational behavior. In the workshop I attended, Zach offered the acronym INVEST to capture his five pillars of consent: informed, voluntary, enthusiastic, specific and timed, as in limited to a defined time frame. In particular, it was the enthusiastic part that stood out to me. In an interview I conducted with Zach for this book, he emphasized how consent activists believe the old standby of, quote, no means no, unquote, is not sufficient to ensure true consent. This is partially because certain circumstances, such as being under the influence of substances, in subspace, or dissociated due to a trauma trigger, can alter our ability to give full consent with our words. Footnote: subspace refers to the trance-like state experienced by some people in a submissive or bottoming role during BDSM play. End footnote. Also, many people struggle with vocalizing a confident no, even if they are clearly saying no with their body language or using different words to communicate their no. Therefore, consent culture raises the bar and brings more nuance to this by introducing the idea that anything short of, in Zach's words, a hell yes, is actually a no. If your answer to whether or not you want to do something with a partner is some variation of, I'm not sure, maybe, or I got to think about it, then for right now, it's a no. In the same way, a hesitant yes, kind of, or possibly, are all also no as well. Essentially, until someone can get to an enthusiastic hell yes on their own, it's a no. The clarity of this advice is powerful because it emboldens people to give themselves permission to say no if they're not 100% on board with something. The consent culture framework that Zach and others promote rightfully cautions us to be aware of the ways we unwittingly give away our power and our voice in relationships, and encourages us to take back the responsibility for setting clear boundaries with others in or out of the bedroom. Learning the importance of having a hell yes before agreeing to anything not only greatly enhances our ability to truly enjoy ourselves, but also means our partners can really trust that we want to be doing whatever it is we're doing. When I introduce this concept of a hell yes to partners that are struggling with things like power imbalances, making clear boundaries, or having issues around sexual satisfaction, the positive results are typically quite notable. So many of us have been taught to undermine our own sense of what we really need and want in a relationship, and unfortunately have learned to make compromises or yield to our partners in ways that ultimately are not sustainable or healthy. However, like any helpful or useful piece of advice, the idea of enthusiastic consent can also, unfortunately, get misused and weaponized. I've seen people use this idea of having an enthusiastic yes as a standard they hold over their partner's heads, expecting them to have an unconditional hell yes to everything they want, no matter what. In some situations, hesitant partners are initially willing to try new or different aspects of non-monogamy, but for various reasons are still not emotionally enthusiastic about it. Instead of being understanding or even grateful that their partners is at least doing their best to get on board with it, the eager person uses the idea of having an enthusiastic hell yes against their partner, and then accuses them of being unsupportive, not having enough compersion, or not being poly enough. On the flip side, I've also seen cases where partners repeatedly dig in their heels and prevent the process of opening up from happening or continuing because they claim their partner shouldn't do anything for which they themselves are not saying hell yes to. In such cases, the idea of a hell yes is either being misused as a form of coercion or as an avoidance tactic. In either case, it is not appropriate or helpful to take a concept like the emphatic yes that was originally designed to be connective or supportive and use it as emotional leverage against the partner. Chapter 1, continued. So what then are we supposed to do when not everyone is enthusiastically on board with CNM? What about all those folks who don't feel a hell yes to non-monogamy? Those who did not seek out non-monogamy, but are being asked or dragged into it by a partner, and are more of a maybe, sort of, or I'm not sure? What about those individuals who feel 1,000 miles away from getting to a clear or effortless yes? Maybe they have a job that could be compromised if their non-monogamous status was revealed, or have loved ones who would reject them and their decision. Maybe they have cultural or religious beliefs that make this paradigm shift harder to fully embrace. Or maybe they weren't the one to initiate non-monogamy, but their fear of losing their partner meant they're reluctantly willing to give it a try. This question of what to do when a partner has ambivalence regarding CNM is not just relevant to people at the beginning of their journey. I have had numerous clients with years of experience with CNM come to me with versions of this very same issue. For example, after years of living in the stability of a hierarchical CNM primary relationship, one partner suddenly announced her desire to start practicing relationship anarchy. Catching her nesting partner of 10 years completely off guard and sending him into an anxious downward spiral. Another individual who had been a part of a relatively happy and secure triad was faced with his other two partners wanting to have a child together, which felt extremely overwhelming and threatening to his attachment with both of his partners. In other situations, I have seen people move new partners into shared living spaces where the original nesting partners were less than thrilled about the new arrival. And I have also dealt with the fallout from people wanting to date individuals within the community or the group of friends of one of their partners. In each of these scenarios, the common thread is that someone makes or wants to make a decision that could dramatically alter the dynamic of a pre-existing CNM relationship. And one or more partners responds then with resistance and trepidation. Ideally, everyone involved in the decision to open up a relationship or initiate changes in a pre-existing CNM relationship would have a resounding and enthusiastic hell yes. However, in cases where one partner still has reservations about the choice, I have recognized the importance of that partner finding their quote-unquote yes to consenting or quote-unquote yes for now. While I consistently coach my clients to embrace the concept of having an enthusiastic hell yes, in regards to sex and to non-sexual acts of service they offer their partners, when it comes to embracing the shift to living non-monogamously, the baseline requirement has some nuance to it. If a couple holds the expectation that all partners involved have to have a hell yes in the face of going non-monogamous, especially in the beginning, this can set them up for disappointment and failure. In this type of situation, what we need to move forward is enough openness to explore and see how things play out. This is also the case in pre-existing CNM relationships where one or more partners are ambivalent about a potential change in their dynamic. Generally speaking, when we truly want something, we're willing to endure the hardships that accompany it. However, there are also numerous times in our lives when, because of another commitment, be it to a partner, child, work, or significant personal goal, we are willing to do things we're not 100% excited about or potentially wouldn't have decided to do on our own. We accept taking on the inconveniences and discomforts associated with the decision because we know it's important to the relationship or goal that we value. Perhaps there is no direct payoff for us, but we recognize the benefit the decision has for the relationship, and thus, for us, it is worth it. This is often the starting point for many partners who would not have chosen non-monogamy on their own. They love their partner so much, they're willing to try it, even in the face of uncertainty and apprehension. In cases like these, the important thing is that the choice is conscious, clear, and uncoerced. When we agree to either opening up our relationship or making a certain transition in a current CNM relationship, we have to be able to articulate why we want to take this journey in the first place. One of the most important things that can support you in moments of difficulty is your capacity to consciously reconnect with your reasons for wanting or just being willing to explore CNM. If changing a paradigm is as arduous as I've described, you have to have a good answer to the question of why on earth you would want to take something like this on. You have to be very clear about why you want it or are willing to explore it. This is the first step, making a conscious and well-thought-out examination of whether or not this is really something you feel on board with and why. As many have already discovered, CNM can throw a lot of curveballs at you. And when the shit starts to hit the fan, it can be vital to remember exactly why you decided to jump into this process. In the hardest moments, you have to remember that you made a choice to be where you are. And as much as it may seem like it, you are not a victim of the circumstances. Explicitly articulating the why of our decision to shift our paradigm to non-monogamy or get on board with a significant change in our current CNM relationship is an important step to anchoring the right frame of mind that I mentioned earlier. It is also a vital part of embracing the commitment to this shift. This step is particularly useful for those who still haven't arrived at their hell yes. While the enthusiasm may still be lagging, you must at least have explicit consent to move forward. The willingness to explore CNM or make a big change in pre-existing relationship has to be mutual and clearly stated among partners before initiating the process. Personally, I like to revisit this upcoming exercise every so often because I find that my why for practicing CNM changes over time. In the process of updating my reasons for wanting to continue practicing CNM, I feel a renewed commitment to my relationships and a deepening of the connection with my partners and myself. Exercise, journaling on your why. Take the time to write out the different reasons why you are consenting to non-monogamy. Some points to consider are, what benefits do you see it offering you? What benefits has it already offered you? What benefits will or does CNM offer your current or future partners? What benefits will or does it bring to your relationships? If you have been practicing CNM, has your why for doing CNM changed? If so, how? After you get more clear on your reasons for practicing CNM, you can now focus more on the specifics of what exactly you are consenting to. Just because you're non-monogamous doesn't mean you have to be up for everything under the sun that would be classified as non-monogamous. For example, many people consent to their partners having other romantic and sexual partners, but that does not mean they have to also consent to seeing or hearing their partners have sex with other people. Other people feel the complete opposite, where they can enthusiastically consent to romance or sexual play as a group experience with their partners, but need more time before they have romantic or sexual experiences separate from their current partners. Temporary CNM vessels for CNM transitions. In the Polysecure Workbook 2022, I described how the radical changes that accompany trying CNM for the first time can initially be too much for some people. I also talked about how for those making big shifts in their current CNM relationships, such as going from a form of hierarchical polyamory to something like non-hierarchical polyamory or relationship anarchy, the transition can provoke a state of crisis and overwhelm. Challenging the tenets of a monogamous paradigm or confronting the lingering effects of couple centricity in your existing relationships can be extremely destabilizing. These kinds of changes can leave you grappling with elevated levels of attachment insecurity, which in turn can make getting to your hell yes seem very difficult. In cases like these, it's wise to have a way of giving your nervous system a chance to catch up and integrate the new experiences. One practical strategy for giving your beleaguered nervous system a much-needed breather is by creating a temporary vessel in which you can slow down your relational explorations and take the time to get your feet back under you. A temporary vessel is an agreement between partners in which one or more people in a particular relationship or relationships intentionally stops pursuing new relationships for a limited period. Some of these vessels are more relevant and useful for couples who are new to being open and struggling with a transition to CNM, while others that I'll mention are more helpful to people who have been already practicing CNM for some time, but need special container to manage and integrate the new relational circumstances and arrangements they're experiencing. There are even vessels for individuals who are not currently in any romantic or intimate partnership, but want to make space for their own personal needs. While it's reasonable to expect some level of discomfort when trying out new things, creating some type of temporary vessel can help you move forward without pushing beyond what your nervous system can legitimately handle. There are many times when CNM will require you to bend, but it should not cause you to break. Similar to the need for training wheels when first learning to ride a bike or using crutches after an injury, the process of creating a temporary vessel can help partners slow down and hopefully reduce some pain and suffering along the way. The concept of a temporary vessel can also be helpful for people who have just experienced some kind of major life event, such as a death of a loved one, the birth of a child, a career change, or move to a new place. These kinds of experiences can create emotional upheaval and instability that make it necessary to simplify things and reduce relational complexity. For example, some partnerships will deliberately opt for a period of polyfidelity, where no new partners are added to the current CNM configuration due to an intensive period of grief or childbearing. Also, some solo poly people or people who are currently unpartnered may create a vessel for themselves, limiting their CNM explorations or interactions with partners during times when they need to focus on their health, education, or a significant life transition. The important thing is that whatever vessel you create, it should be tailored to meet the needs of your particular relationships. Here are some examples of different vessels that I've seen clients try. The first two in particular are more geared towards couples and offer practical ways for gradually dipping your toes into the uncertain waters of open relating by seeing how things go before plunging headfirst into fully committed relationships with other people. This gives couples the opportunity to have new experiences within the container of a highly structured framework and allows them to assess the impact of those experiences and decide whether to proceed with their explorations. The third vessel is for partners who, for various reasons, feel the need to create a bubble of exclusivity around their relationship for a time. The fourth vessel is particularly for people in pre-existing non-monogamous relationship structures. And finally, the last vessel can be applied to any relationship configuration, regardless of how many people there are. Here's a list of potential vessel options. A staggered approach to dating others. One partner will start dating other people for a specific amount of time before their partner also begins seeing other people. Typically, what happens in these situations is that at the end of the allotted time frame, the original partners talk about how things have been for each other and then decide how to proceed. Next, an experimental period of partial non-monogamy. Partners pick a period of several months during which they agree to explore certain types of open experiences, whether romantic or purely sexual, that they engage in both together or separately, and that initially feel safe or less threatening. Examples of things that people do in this kind of vessel include attending play parties or other kind of group-centered sex-positive events, participate in CNM meetups, creating profiles and beginning to meet people on dating apps, and going to conferences and festivals that are geared towards CNM audiences. At the end of this period, they reassess what worked and what didn't, and then mutually figure out what additional experiences they want to include or explore. Note that if you're going to try either of the aforementioned vessels, it's important to let the people you're exploring with know that you're either in a CNM trial period or that you are not fully available for a committed relationship so that expectations or hopes can be transparent and realistic. Also, if you are considering these options, please take the time to include in your discussions anyone who would be impacted by your decisions so that they can have genuine input into whatever process you are initiating. The next vessel is a phase of exclusivity. This refers to taking a period to be exclusive with just one partner, where neither of you are pursuing or relating to additional people in romantic or sexual ways, even through messaging or apps, in order to focus on what you need individually and together to heal and feel safe and ready enough to move forward with dating others outside the vessel. This could be applied equally to a couple feeling the need to return to a container of exclusivity, as to people within a current CNM partnership who have decided they need a temporary structure of this kind of vessel. The next one is temporary polyfidelity. This vessel is meant to support partners who are involved in multiple relationships, i.e. situations involving more than two people, where everyone agrees to stop seeing new people or take on new partners. All current relationships continue as they are, but the individuals in them are closed to any new partners, essentially making them polyfidelitous for a predetermined amount of time. The next potential vessel is taking a pause. This is similar to the previously mentioned vessel of exclusivity in the sense that partners within a given dyad could decide to put a pause on seeking out any new relationships with other people. However, it offers more possibilities for maintaining certain aspects of other relationships, including newer connections during the pause. For example, someone taking a pause might decide to put a hold on the more romantic or sexual dimensions of their newer relationships, but still maintain the platonic or the emotional, intellectual elements of those connections. For others, taking a break or pause can mean intentionally taking some distance from certain relationships for a while, then later resuming these connections. A pause is unique in that the underlying intention is not to end any particular relationship, but merely to modify it or put it on hold while someone figures out what they need to take care of themselves and their relationships. The vessels I have mentioned here may or may not be right for you and your unique situation. Some things I suggest may be possible for you depending on how far along you are in your personal process and what your constellation of partnerships looks like at the moment. Additionally, vessels can be introduced at any point along your CNM journey, not just at the beginning. It is also important that people not make agreements they don't want to make or can't actually follow through on. Be honest about your needs and realistic with what you can offer, remembering that temporary vessels are a great way to support you in times of change and transition. Regardless of the vessel you choose, remember that its purpose is to create the space for answering what exactly you're saying yes to and no to. Once you reach the end of a time set aside for a vessel, you can extend it for another amount of time. You can expand the parameters or conditions of the existing vessel, or simply release the vessel altogether. I've found that partners who do well with creating a vessel and then are able to later expand beyond it typically have at least two of the following three supports in place. Weekly non-monogamy check-ins together, such as the radar process outlined by the Multiamory podcast, individual support from a professional to work on healing their respective attachment wounds, work through any jealousy or personal insecurities, and create more personal readiness for the process, and relationship coaching or therapy specifically for CNM and attachment repair as partners. What I have seen that does not work well when trying to create a vessel is when people try to create a vessel to control their partners, stall the non-monogamy process, or control any potential metamors. People do not actually want to do CNM at all, and so no matter how many vessels you create to ease someone into the process, it's just not going to work. And partners are not doing their individual inner work within the vessel to grow, heal, and gain the skills and capacities they need to expand beyond the vessel they created. The last thing I want to say about vessels is that it's important to consider the feelings and experiences of everyone who could be affected by implementing a particular vessel. There are times when people create vessels without having to end pre-existing relationships, and other times when they do. And the latter often involves the painful process of ending relationships in which an emotional attachment has already formed. This can have a significant emotional impact on individuals who are left out of the decision-making process. If the latter is the case, make the effort to include these partners in an open and honest conversation about why you're making this particular decision. Be prepared to hold space for their emotions and sincerely acknowledge the impact of these changes on their experience. Exercise. CNM vessel. Use the following questions and prompts to craft a vessel for yourself or for your relationships. If you are intending to create a vessel for one or more of your relationships, invite all the relevant partners to participate in this process. Take turns answering these questions and don't rush the process. Vessels that are the most supportive and successful are usually ones that have had a few revisions along the way. Questions. When you read about the above examples of possible vessels, which one speaks to you? which ones don't? Why? If you could craft your own vessel, what would it look like and how long would it last? What do you think this would offer you and your relationships? What needs does this potential vessel meet for you? What are your intentions for the vessel? State your intentions in positive language, focusing on what you want to experience versus what you want to avoid. What commitments can you make during this time to focus on your own inner work? What commitments can you make during this time to get support as partners? Who else would be affected by this vessel, and how can you include and/or inform them about the vessel you are implementing? After you and your partner or partners each share your preferred vessels, take the time to negotiate one that fits enough of what you'll all need and want, and then go try it out. I suggest trying it out for a shorter period, say for a week or two, to make sure that each of you feels like you can fully consent to the vessel you've created, and that no one has said yes to things they don't actually want to do, or may not be able to realistically follow through on. Don't forget to schedule your check-ins. After the initial 2-week trial period, make any necessary changes or updates to your vessel, then agree to a longer time frame to implement it. Exercise. Your general statements of consent. Create one or two clear statements that articulate your consent to non-monogamy. Make these statements reflective of your choice to do C&M, not anyone else's choice or reason. Even if you think you're only doing it because your partner wants you to, you are still making an intentional choice to try out non-monogamy because you want to stay with your partner. That's on you, not them. I would not recommend moving forward with C&M if you feel like you are being forced or manipulated into it. And as further explored in the next chapter, you have every right to say that C&M is not for you. With that said, if you are going to move forward with it, I suggest finding the places within yourself that are consenting and willing to move forward and make them clear to yourself and your partner. A few examples of statements that reflect the varying expressions of consent are, I really want to do this for myself. I really want to do this for us. I'm curious about this and willing to experiment. I see the importance of this for my relationship, and I'm willing to give it a try. Even though this may not have been my first choice, I am consenting to seeing if this can work before giving up on my current relationship. Before moving on, I want to offer an important caveat. C&M requires a lot of transparency and trust. It can be an incredibly vulnerable and complex relational space to step into. If you are in a situation where your partner began exploring non-monogamy without your consent, i.e. by cheating, and is now trying to recruit you, you absolutely have the right to say no and request that quote-unquote affair repair happen before moving forward into C&M. When one partner hasn't had the opportunity to say yes to opening up the relationship before it happens, it is unreasonable to expect them to unquestionably go along with it now. This is a significant violation of trust that must be addressed before any more discussions around opening up can safely continue. If a partner's hesitation around non-monogamy stems from this kind of rupture, it must be treated differently than the situations I have just mentioned where no previous dishonesty has occurred, but one partner still feels reluctant and uncertain. Paradigm awareness and deconstruction. Paradigm awareness is about making the unconscious conscious through a deliberate examination of the core elements of the paradigms that shape our way of seeing and experiencing the world. With paradigm awareness, we look not just at the vestiges of the old paradigm we are trying to shed, but also the tenets of the new one we are attempting to adopt. We bring to light and articulate the things we want to leave behind, as well as the new ways of thinking and behaving we want to integrate. It is also an opportunity to recognize the ways we have grown and changed or continue to stay the same over the years. For anyone facing challenges in their CNM journey, I strongly recommend undertaking the process of developing paradigm awareness and intentionally outlining the core elements of both the monogamous and non-monogamous paradigms that influence your way of thinking and behaving in relationships. When we first become curious about the ways we have internalized monogamous culture, it can be overwhelming because we are completely surrounded by it. We very quickly realize how thoroughly we are inundated with movies, shows, songs, and social norms that constantly reinforce the monogamous ideal. While many of the beliefs and tenets of the monogamous paradigm are quite obvious, others are more subtle and harder to recognize. In order to shine a light on the more unconscious aspects of an internalized monogamous mindset, we have to examine all the taken-for-granted thoughts, behaviors, and feelings associated with this worldview. Without criticizing, judging, or placing blame on ourselves or anyone else, we deliberately cultivate the ability to notice all of the stories that pass through our mind about how relationships are supposed to be. As you do this practice of observing your paradigms, staying curious and open to whatever arises in your process will support you in disentangling the elements of the monogamous paradigm that continue to be problematic. Exercise: monogamous stories. The underlying values and ideas of any given paradigm are embedded in the stories we hear and tell. In the same way as we use fables as a convenient way to teach morals to children, so too as adults do we rely on narratives to transmit and reinforce the values that underlie our paradigms. The following is an exercise to help you pick out and recognize which stories have shaped your monogamous worldview. You can do this as a journal exercise or use the questions as prompts for a conversation that you have with someone else. Growing up, what stories, anecdotes, or gossip did you hear from the adults you knew about love, sex, romance, marriage, and partnership? What did the presence or absence of these stories teach you about love, sex, romance, marriage, and partnership? What specific lessons, whether explicit or implicit, did you learn about monogamy and non-monogamy? Ask the same above questions regarding the stories you heard from movies, music, media, or friends growing up. Reflect on how these encouraged or discouraged a monogamous worldview. As an adult, what stories do your peers or social groups tell about love, sex, romance, marriage, and partnership? How has this impacted your monogamous or non-monogamous views? How has this impacted the choices you have made regarding love, sex, romance, marriage, and partnership? Next, write down the feelings that arise when you think about how these stories continue to affect your experience. Does this awareness make you mad, frustrated, or righteously indignant? Maybe you feel guilty or ashamed for continuing to find yourself in their gravitational pull, or maybe there's positive feelings. Allow whatever comes up without making any special effort to change or do anything about it. For now, awareness is our only goal. The more energy you put into identifying the monogamous stories that still have a hold on you, the more you can start to weaken their grip. It becomes easier to start seeing them as merely stories as opposed to facts or statements about absolute reality. Exercise: creating your own old and new paradigm chart. For this exercise, draw a line down the center of a page to create two columns. The left column will consist of the monogamous beliefs that you are deconstructing, and the right side will be a list of the non-monogamous beliefs that you are already living or currently constructing. Step 1. On the left side, write out all of the monogamous beliefs you can think of. These don't have to be all the ones you totally believe in, but they are ones that nevertheless show up regularly in your field of awareness. They might hook you, and they probably have had an impact on you and your relationships. Step 2, read through your list of monogamous beliefs. Reflect and tune in to how you feel when you read them. Do these beliefs resonate in your body? Do any feelings of shame, guilt, or should arise? Do you relax or tense up as you read some or all of them? Do they feel like they lead you closer to or further from the partnerships or sexual expressions that you want? Step 3, in the right column, write out the non-monogamous beliefs that are a counter belief or a new updated equivalent belief from the monogamous one in the opposite column. Read through and reflect on your non-monogamous beliefs just as you did on the first column. Contemplate the same questions as in step 2, and also pay attention to anything that's different about your experience during this second round of reflections. Here's a sample of a paradigm belief chart. So I will read the monogamous belief that's on the left, and then I will switch to the non-monogamous belief that's either an equivalent updated version. Monogamous belief. Long-term monogamous relationships are the only real or legitimate relationships. The non-monogamous belief might be, romantic and intimate relationships can unfold in many ways. There is no one standard for love. A monogamous belief, if you are truly in love with someone, you won't be interested in anyone else. The updated non-monogamous belief could be, love is not inherently exclusive and can be genuinely felt and expressed in more than one relationship at a time. The next possible monogamous belief can be, you can get too close to other people. Connecting with others outside of a relationship is dangerous. The non-monogamous belief for this might be, connection with others is expansive and relationship enhancing. The more connected I feel, the more I have to offer all my partners. Monogamous belief, my partner should be the one and only who takes care of my needs for intimacy and connection, and vice versa. The non-monogamous belief on the right-hand column could be, it is impossible for one person to meet all of another person's needs, and having multiple intimate connections can free us up from thinking that we have to be everything for each other. Monogamous belief, the need or desire for space in a relationship means something is wrong. The non-monogamous belief, taking space for oneself and having separate experiences supports individual autonomy and can help maintain a romantic or sexual spark. Monogamous belief, if a partner is attracted to someone else, it's because I'm not enough. The non-monogamous belief might be, attraction can be diverse, and my or my partner's attraction to others has nothing to do with a deficiency in self or other. And finally, the last sample example could be, monogamy is just easier. The non-monogamous belief here might be, some aspects of having only one partner are easier, and others are harder. Deconstructing the old to make room for the preferred. To successfully integrate the paradigmatic beliefs with which we feel most aligned, we must create space for them by clearing out any opposing beliefs still lingering from the previous paradigm. Because the beliefs from our old paradigms can continue to exert a powerful influence over us, we need to actively challenge them, reminding ourselves how they no longer serve us. The purpose of the paradigm belief chart is to help you further distinguish between the beliefs of the past that you want to shed and the ones that you want to integrate into your life now. After creating your initial paradigm belief chart, continue rereading your monogamous beliefs column to deepen your awareness of the monogamous beliefs you no longer want to endorse or enact. Many of these old beliefs are inherited from the culture in which we were raised. Recognizing them as products of our social environment versus reflections of ultimate truth can loosen the sense that they have that they are fixed or unchangeable. The more we unpack the socially constructed nature of these beliefs, the more agency we possess to choose whether or not we uphold them. Developing this capacity to consciously choose the beliefs we embody is at the heart of the practice of deconstructing our old beliefs. When you encounter these beliefs in the world, or they show up in your own inner voice as self-judgment or criticism, challenge them by asking yourself the following questions. Whose beliefs are these? Are these my beliefs or someone else's? What values or feelings are these beliefs an expression of? What impact do these beliefs have on me? What beliefs about love, partnership, or sex do I want to align myself with? As you continue to deconstruct the old beliefs that no longer serve you, you will also name the beliefs with which you do resonate. As you do this, it is helpful to identify the values that underlie your preferred beliefs. Directly connecting with the values that are reflected in our beliefs bolsters our emotional connection to them and strengthens our resolve to live accordingly. The more we consciously align with our preferred values, the more sensitized we become to the moments when we fall out of alignment. This creates a positive feedback loop where we start to pay more attention to the things we really want in life. I also recommend seeking alternative resources that debunk some of the myths we have inherited about sex, gender, and the history of monogamy. Footnote: I suggest the following resources for a more in-depth exploration of common myths regarding sex, gender, and monogamy. The book The Myth of Monogamy, the book Sex at Dawn, the book Race, Monogamy, and Other Lies They Told You, the book Untrue, Why Nearly Everything We Believe About Women, Lust, and Infidelity is Wrong, and How the New Science Can Set Us Free, the book The Importance of Being Monogamous, and the book Marriage, A History, How Love Conquered Marriage. End footnote. Exposing yourself to new or lesser-known science and more accurate portrayals of history can be a tremendous support in fortifying your paradigm shift. Continuing to internalize your non-monogamous paradigm beliefs. After beginning the initial work of deconstructing the monogamous paradigm and identifying all the beliefs and values of CNM we want to embody, we then move on to the phase of internalization and integration. While the desire may be to rush ahead, we actually want to slow down a bit and take our time with this part of the process. We live in an increasingly impatient world where we can instantly download entirely new operating systems for our computers, talk to people on the other side of the earth in real time, and even order anything we want online with the expectation it will arrive at maximum in 2 days. Who hasn't fantasized about the possibility of simply plugging in a cable into the back of their heads like Neo from The Matrix and then proclaiming, "I know Kung Fu"? I would love to be able to instantly learn to dance like a pro, complete a degree or speed read, or to learn another language in a matter of minutes. And yet, at least for now, some things still take time. In shifting from one paradigm to another, there is no magic pill to bypass the steps it takes to learn new skills, rewire old patterns of emotional reactivity, embody new ways of being, or change core beliefs about how relationships are supposed to be. As much as we may not like it, it just takes time, and we need to have patience. Integration only happens through repeated and sustained exposure to the ideas, principles, practices, habits, stories, and experiences that make up any given paradigm. No one internalizes a new paradigm simply by reading something once or listening to a few podcasts about the subject of interest. Instead, we repeatedly gather new information, acquire knowledge, have conversations, go to conferences, attend meetups and workshops, and form new relationships. We need to immerse ourselves in the worldview we are trying to live in order for it to truly take hold in our consciousness. This consistent repetition reinforces the circuits in our brains associated with particular experiences, forming more neural connections for whatever it is we want to learn. In neuroscience, the well-known Hebbian theory states that neurons that fire together wire together, meaning our brain's neural pathways are reinforced through the same repeated actions or behaviors. The more we think, feel, and encounter a certain concept or experience, the stronger the neural circuits associated with the particular stimulus becomes. This means as we expose ourselves to new material and experiences, we literally strengthen the neural pathways associated with the new information. Therefore, the key to internalizing and sustaining the changes we want to make is to maintain the consistency of exposure necessary to develop these enhanced neural connections. By immersing ourselves in a non-monogamous paradigm and the repetition of its beliefs, over time, we begin to feel the world through the lens of the new paradigm. Returning back to your paradigm belief chart, from the right-hand side of the chart, rereading your more preferred paradigm beliefs is a great start. Some additional things you can do to reinforce the continued internalization of these beliefs are: repeat your new beliefs often to yourself. Find evidence of your new beliefs in the stories of others. Find evidence in your own life, no matter how small, of your new beliefs. Visualize yourself in situations that validate your new beliefs. Act your new beliefs out in the world. Find friends and communities that share these beliefs. Additional supports for making a paradigm shift. Aside from the above concepts and exercises, you can also use additional supports to help facilitate your paradigm shift. The following list suggests a few practices and modalities that are known to support people in changing their reactivity and subconscious or habitual thoughts and beliefs in order to leverage the conscious mind for more lasting change. Not all of the following items are for everyone, so please only consider the ones that feel right and supportive to you, as well as appropriate to your current medical or mental health conditions. Meditation. The practice of using a technique such as mindfulness or focusing the mind on a particular object, such as the breath, mantra, one's body, or thoughts, in order to train the mind's attention and awareness in new ways. Hypnotherapy or self-hypnosis. Through the use of a practitioner or by oneself, inducing a trance-like state of consciousness, in which a person is more responsive to the suggestion of new thoughts, beliefs, and behaviors. Holotropic breathwork, a method of breathwork created by Czech psychiatrist Stanislav Grof to induce altered states of consciousness for healing, growth, and personal transformation. Plant medicine journeys, microdosing, ketamine-assisted psychotherapy, or MDMA-assisted psychotherapy. The use of plant medicine, psychedelics, or other mind-altering substances to work through traumas, grief, depression, anxiety, and emotional stuckness, as well as to expand one's consciousness and life perspective. If you explore this route, it is extremely important that you work with practitioners who have the appropriate training, experience, and safety protocols. Emotional freedom technique, EFT, tapping, a technique where people focus on a specific distressing situation, limiting thoughts or beliefs they would like to change while tapping with their fingers on certain acupressure points in order to change their emotional reaction and intensity. Eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, EMDR, a therapy designed to facilitate the processing and resolution of traumatic memories and other adverse life experiences. It is also used to work with reprogramming negative beliefs and emotional triggers, or reactivity. Taken together, the practices and techniques presented in this chapter offer a framework with which you can thoughtfully and gradually retrain your nervous system to more easily manage and integrate the challenges and complexities of CNM. While each practice offers something unique and valuable on its own, when done in combination, they form the foundation of a very useful skill set that will serve you throughout your journey with CNM. One of the most important things I want to emphasize is the value of having some kind of structured approach guiding your process. What Dave and I each find with clients in our respective practices is that more often than not, people struggling with their relationship to CNM are shooting in the dark without resources, techniques, or a coherent line of action to guide or assist them. Applying the practices offered in this section will remedy that feeling of being completely lost or overwhelmed and give much needed direction to those still grappling with internalizing or integrating a non-monogamous paradigm. In concluding this chapter on paradigms, I just want to reiterate the importance of slowing down and anchoring yourself in the capacity to take the long view. When making the transition into CNM or changing the style of CNM that you are practicing, urgency can be one of your greatest obstacles. New things take time to come to fruition. Even though everyone is different in terms of the particular stage and phase of their CNM journey, any new situations and circumstances that arise will always require skill and patience to successfully navigate. The process of making big paradigm shifts should be approached like a marathon, not a sprint. If you are overly focused on quickly having a particular experience or are desperate to, quote unquote, fix a struggling relationship with CNM, chances are you are setting yourself up for a crash and burn situation. Integration is a deliberate and gradual process that happens in an organic way over time. Remember, monogamous beliefs that have been internalized over the course of a lifetime do not simply vanish because you decide to think and act differently one day. We are talking about deeply rooted thought and behavioral patterns that have been and continue to be reinforced by mainstream culture. It can take tremendous perseverance to undo these kinds of patterns and integrate new ones. The people who make the biggest strides are typically the ones who are willing to slow down and work together. They recognize the importance of maintaining a collaborative approach and can give each other the space to adjust and integrate each new phase of the process. Conversely, the partnerships that struggle the most are precisely the ones where someone is reluctant or unsure about making a transition, while others are totally hell-bent on moving as fast as possible. Within the subtext of this imbalance of wants is typically the tension between the desire for safety versus the yearning for freedom. When partners are unable to recognize the importance of prioritizing the well-being of the relationship over immediate personal gratification, the transitions within CNM tend to be extremely painful and destructive. This is why it's critical for partners to think in terms of paradigms, recognizing they are embarking on a much larger process of rewriting their fundamental relationship narratives together. When they see and understand the situation this way, partners can have a much more patient and compassionate view of each other, recognizing that everyone involved is actively undoing potentially a lifetime of monogamous social conditioning.